Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello, and welcome to EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. My name is Melinda Maggiari, and I am a professor at the University of Copenhagen, a consultant neurologist, and leader of the Danish Multiple Sclerosis Registry. In today's episode, I'm joined by a colleague from ECTRIMS, Brett Drummond. Hello, Brett. Could you please introduce yourself?
Hi, Melinda. Thanks for having me on this episode. So my name is Brett Drummond. I'm a multiple sclerosis researcher, science communicator, and co-founder of MS Translate. MS Translate is an official communications partner of ECTRIMS, and I'm one of the hosts of the official ECTRIMS podcast.
Thank you for joining. Our topic today is the ECTRIMS EAN vaccination consensus statement, and therefore our special guest is Susanna Otero. Susanna Otero is a preventive medicine and epidemiology specialist and a master in public health. She's the head of the epidemiology and public health research group of the Vallebrun Research Institute and also a consultant physician at the preventive medicine department, also at the Vallebrun University Hospital. She's a full professor at the Universitat Autonoma of Barcelona in Spain. She holds a research post in the MS Center of Catalonia, SEMCAT, conducting epidemiological and clinical research with the main focus of immunization and risk mitigation strategies in MS. She has led the National Spanish Consensus and also the European ECTRIMS EAN Joint Consensus for Vaccination in MS Patients. Hello, Susanna, and welcome to this podcast.
Hello, thank you for having me. It's really a pleasure to be in this podcast today.
Let's start with the very basic question. Why considering vaccination in MS patients?
Well, we have witnessed over the past years clear advances in treatment options for patients with MS with a very positive impact on disease prognosis. But these therapies, mostly those high efficacious therapies, have large immunosuppressive effects with important B and T cell depletion. So in this context, patients, MS patients, face an increased risk of infections, both new infections, but also reactivation of potential latent pathogens. And we know about this risk of infections from all the clinical development process of these new drugs, but also from several population-based studies showing this higher risk of hospitalization due to infections and shorter time to first serious infections in patients under these therapies. Less is published about the impact on common non-serious infections, but there is some available data showing an increased risk of these common respiratory, urinary infections that have a great impact and pose a great burden to the patients. So the good news is that some of these infections can be prevented through vaccination, and that is the main reason why these patients should always opt to these vaccinations, mostly in the context of potential future immunosuppression. And some good examples about the benefit of these vaccines, maybe the closest example comes from the COVID-19 pandemic, where mostly those elderly patients with advanced disability and those patients on anti-CD20 therapies were at greatest risk of severe disease and had a clear benefit from vaccination with COVID-19 vaccines. But there are other examples, and some of them with very also recently available vaccines, such as the herpes zoster vaccine, that is clearly an issue in patients under immunosuppression and also in patients with advanced age. So elderly patients face a higher risk of developing a herpes zoster with all the potential long-term consequences, such as post-herpetic neuralgia. So receiving the herpes zoster vaccine with a very high effectiveness against herpes zoster is clearly a benefit for those patients under immunosuppressive therapies. But there are other vaccines that are also highly recommended in patients with MS, such as the influenza or the pneumococcal vaccines, to prevent those more commonly acquired respiratory infections and even serious pneumococcal infections. So for all these reasons, all these vaccines should always be considered, or at least there's a clear assessment should be done in each individual patient to evaluate whether some of these vaccines would be recommended.
Yeah, and I think it's really important that we have clear messaging around this. And so I think it's fantastic that we're recording this episode. You've touched on a couple of the vaccines already, COVID being one of them that's obviously been at the forefront of our minds in recent years, and one which we have seen a large amount of data published around the safety and efficacy of vaccines in that for people living with MS. But I guess for other ones as well, do we have that same level of evidence for all of the different vaccines that we may be recommending for people living with MS?
Well, the answer would be no. We do not have the same amount of data. Probably COVID-19 and also influenza take up most of the available data on vaccine safety. But it's also true that we do have quite a number of studies performed over the last 20 years supporting the safe use of vaccine in MS patients. And it's true that we come from a history of distrust in vaccines in the MS world. And you would probably recall the late 90s in the context of a mass vaccination campaign against hepatitis B in adolescent population in France, with more than 20 million people being vaccinated. And there was a report of several new cases of MS that raised an important concern, and the campaign was temporarily suspended. And there was a whole technical report by the Global Advisory Committee on Vaccine Safety of the WHO trying to figure out whether that was just a coincidence, it was just a trigger in predisposed individuals, or there was really a causal association between the hepatitis B vaccine and that onset of MS. And after looking at the data, the conclusion that was that there was no reason to suggest a change in the recommendations, and there wasn't enough data to support a causal relationship between this hepatitis B vaccine and those onset of MS, those cases of MS. But shortly after that, in 2001, I think that the most relevant study on vaccine safety was published, and this was a work done by the group of Confavre, published in New England Journal of Medicine. And it had a case crossover design that has been used in several other studies recently, where each patient was their own control. And the study involved more than 600 patients looking at different vaccines and trying to see if there were higher chances of having received a vaccine in the period at risk, and that was prior to a relapse, compared to other non-risk periods. And the study failed to see any relationship between vaccination and posterior risk of relapses. And after that study, several other, maybe not as large, but other studies all pointed towards the same direction. So absence of risk, mostly with influenza vaccines.
Last
other
year,
data coming from France, from a large population-based study looking at over 50,000 hospitalizations due to an MS relapse, and try to see if that hospitalization was associated with a previous vaccination. Looking at different vaccines in this case, it was influenza, pneumococcal vaccine, tetanus vaccine as well, and some of the combinations. Combined vaccines, I mean, and there was no association between that previous vaccination and the risk of hospitalization due to an MS. Recently, the COVID-19 pandemic has made available a very large amount of data on vaccine safety. with the particular interest that we are looking at a new vaccine technology, because mRNA vaccines hadn't been used before. And so a very large number of unicentric, but also multicentric studies, and more recently, even population-based studies published just this year, such as the study coming from the MS Danish Registry and another large study in France with over 100,000 vaccinated individuals, and looking at the potential association between vaccination and relapse in the 90 or in the 180 days after vaccination. And none of these studies demonstrated an association between vaccination and relapse, with the only detail of a specific subgroup of patients that were the most highly active patients with relapses in the previous year or in the previous 2 years before vaccination, that were generally younger patients, non-exposed to DMTs at the time of vaccination. And in this particular subgroup, there was a slight increase in the risk of relapses, which could probably lead to recommend that in these patients, it would be wise to vaccinate while the patient is already under DMTs to try and avoid this potential risk of relapse that probably is related to the baseline disease activity more than the trigger of the vaccine itself.
Thank you so much. On other issue, it can be the reduced vaccine immunogenicity in patients treated with disease modifying therapy. So when we advise patients, we take the vaccine history, take the lifestyle, then advise them for a battery of vaccine. But how do we handle this reduced vaccine immunogenicity? Are there any strategies to optimize the response of the vaccines?
Well, in fact, that is an excellent question. We now have a much more clear idea of what are the disease-modifying therapies that can interfere in vaccine responses, in immunogenicity. And that, again, we have to thank the COVID-19 pandemic, because some of this data is clearly coming from very recent studies, and they're all very consistent in showing that anti-CD20 therapies and S1P modulators, mostly those non-selective, have a clear impact on vaccine responses. And not so much other therapies, which seem to preserve quite well the antibody response. There's not that much data on cellular response. We do have for COVID-19, but not so much for other vaccines. So previous studies before COVID-19 that were mostly focusing on influenza vaccines, also pneumococcal, we do have the Veloce study. All those studies primarily focused on antibody response. So taking all these together, we can probably say that most of the DMTs are okay. Of course, all the injectables or the first line are okay and do not clearly impair immune responses. And the red flag would be on S1P, anti-CD20 therapy, and immune reconstitution therapies probably during the first months after treatment. So having this in mind, the recommendations or the strategies that you were mentioning would be, on the first place, the most simple one would be, well, advanced vaccination. So try to administer the vaccines before the patient is already under these immunosuppressive therapies. And for inactivated vaccines, in fact, the recommendation would be to administer the vaccine just 2 weeks in advance to allow for a complete response to the vaccine. And for live attenuated vaccines, the reason is different. So here we want to ensure safety. So the vaccine should be administered at least 4 weeks in advance of an onset of immunosuppressive therapy. Because we have a transient infection due to the attenuated virus or the attenuated bacteria, and we want to make sure that the response to that transient infection is complete before immunosuppression takes place. So if we can advance vaccination, we can gain a better response to the vaccine. And in the particular case for live attenuated vaccine, we can ensure safety. But of course, this could be feasible in some cases, and mostly for those vaccines with a single dose scheme. So just a single dose, we're thinking about a COVID-19 booster or tetanus booster or even pneumococcal vaccine, which is administered in a single dose. But when we look at vaccines with multiple dose schemes, such as hepatitis B or even herpes zoster HPV vaccines, we have a little more of a problem to advance vaccination if we want to start a specific immunosuppressive therapy. And in that particular situation, I would say that our experience, and we have analyzed patients receiving hepatitis B vaccines. This is a four-dose vaccination scheme that we did over a lapse of 6 months. And those patients were planned to start, in an important number of them, anti-CD20 therapy. So we're looking at over 300 patients, and in over 100, there was an onset of anti-CD20 therapy. And in this case, we saw that the number of doses administered before the onset of immunosuppression mattered, in the sense that there was a dose response effect. So administering only one dose of the whole vaccination scheme before anti-CD20 therapy only led to less than 18% seroprotection, as compared to, for instance, three doses of vaccine that almost or even more than two-thirds of the patients achieved an adequate seroprotection at the end of the whole vaccination course. So the recommendation would be, if you don't have much time, try to administer as many doses as possible of a multi-dose scheme and not just say, well, we're not vaccinating, we do not have time. So advancing at least a number of doses makes a difference in terms of seroprotection, at least from our experience, and this is data that will be published recently. The other situation is where it really is not possible because there's an urgency to start a disease-modifying therapy. And in this case, one option would be to place a patient on a therapy that allows for a good immune response of the vaccine. And a good example of this would be natalizumab. Natalizumab is a very good option for this particular situation due to its mechanism of action with preserved peripheral immune function. And it is a drug that has proven preserved immune responses to the vaccines. We published early this year seroprotection rates against COVID-19, hepatitis B, and hepatitis A that were over 90% for all the vaccines in patients that were vaccinated while receiving natalizumab. So the possibility of using this drug as a bridge therapy before moving on to anti-CD20, for instance, and administering the vaccine in the patient while being treated with natalizumab seems like a potential good option. Of course, we'll have to be confirmed with other studies, but it would be a very good option for highly active patients in which advancing vaccination is not an option. Then we can face the third situation in this case. That would be, what about if the patient is already receiving one of those immunosuppressive therapies with a clear impact on vaccine responses? And in that case, one of the potential strategies, which in fact is not always feasible for all patients, would be looking for that window of opportunity. So trying to administer the vaccine where the immune function is highest. And this is thinking about, for instance, anti-CD20 therapy administered every 6 months. So trying to find that period where there's the highest immune reconstitution, which is not always there for all the patients, but that would be the time, probably 5 months after the previous infusion, or it would be ideally the best moment to administer the vaccine for a better immune response. Data supporting this is coming basically from COVID-19 pandemic. And an important point to make here is that in some of the studies that proved better responses in this window of opportunity were done in situations where there were extended dosing intervals. So we're looking at 9 months after the last infusion and not probably 4 to 5 months. So probably this window of opportunity, it's not a realistic situation for infusions every 6 months, and of course for other treatment schemes which do not allow for this period of vaccination. And of course, in immune reconstitution therapies, the recommendation would be wait until the patient has a full B and C and T cell recovery. Again, this has to be always balanced with the opportunity of vaccination, because if we're considering, for instance, influenza vaccine, we might want to give the vaccine at the beginning of the influenza season, regardless of the previous treatment, and not wait until the last months of the season where the benefit of receiving the vaccine is much less because there's no virus circulating. So this has to be individualize it for different vaccines and for different epidemiological situations. A last strategy, and this has more to do with the vaccination part itself, would be try to use those vaccines that are more immunogenic. And for some types of vaccines, for instance, hepatitis B, we do have vaccines with enhanced immunogenicity, and this would be higher antigenic load. So we do have double dose vaccines, for instance, or adjuvanted vaccines that potentiate the immune response. And for instance, for influenza, we usually reserve those adjuvanted vaccines for elderly patients over 60. But there are some recommendations of using these particular adjuvanted vaccines also for younger individuals if they're in an immunosuppressive situation. And then something that has not directly relation with improved immunogenicity, but is also relevant, is how to ensure good immunization against live attenuated vaccine in these patients that are about to start immunosuppression, because that is a situation in which if we cannot wait to start therapy, then we cannot vaccinate. And we probably do not want to leave the patient susceptible to varicella, for instance, if they're going to start anti-CD20 therapy. So in those situations, our experience was, what about administering just a single dose of the vaccine? Because both varicella and measles, mumps, rubella are vaccines that have to be administered in two doses, separated at least 1 month. But these vaccines are highly immunogenic. So the live attenuated vaccines simulate a natural infection, and they're really very effective. So probably a single dose would be enough for an adequate protection. And that is what we tested in a study published last year. And we saw that this single dose strategy, so just one dose and then post-vaccination serology to confirm protection, and the patient would be ready to start immunosuppression after that, protected over two-thirds of the patients. So probably if we're in a situation of urgency to start therapy, trying out with a single dose of varicella or a single dose of measles, mumps, rubella, in case the patient is susceptible, of course, that would be a good strategy to try and not prevent the patient from being protected.
Yeah, I mean, it's fantastic to see how much progress we've made in this space and how much new data we have to guide these decisions. Shifting our attention to what comes next, and I guess to close the episode, I'd be interested in hearing your thoughts around what you think the priorities are for future research in the field of MS and immunizations. What are the questions that are still left to be answered?
I think that there's still quite a work ahead. In fact, just to start by one of the thoughts on what comes next, we've talked much about all the information that we do have on COVID-19 vaccines, previously probably also on influenza vaccine. But I would be interested in looking at how are other vaccines working for MS patients. And in this regard, for instance, herpes zoster vaccine, which is a quite recent vaccine, it has only been available in Spain in the last 2 years. Probably Canada, US, Germany have a larger experience because it has been there for longer. But we do not have specific data, nor in the clinical development or the vaccine or any observational data later on how our vaccine responses to herpes zoster vaccine. I would expect that the vaccine works very well because all the clinical development has been done in highly immunosuppressed patients, such as hemophagocytic transplant, HIV, kidney transplant patients. So probably in MS patients, even those under immunosuppressive therapies, the response of the vaccine would be good, but that has to be proven, and seeing data on that would be quite interesting. Also, another recently available vaccine, such as the new pneumococcal 20-valent vaccine that we're currently using just as a single dose, and there's no data on immunosuppressed population, of course not in specific MS patients. And we did know that the sequential scheme of conjugate 13 plus the polysaccharidic 23-valent vaccine did have good responses in patients treated with ocrelizumab, and that is data from the Veloce study. So it would be nice to see how is this new pneumococcal vaccine performing in patients, mostly those under immunosuppressive therapies. New data for new vaccines would be one of the key points. Another important aspect that has been mentioned before is whether natalizumab is a good option for immunization of patients, of mostly those highly active patients. And I think we have some data already on its value for inactivated vaccines. But probably a step ahead would be, what about also using natalizumab with live attenuated vaccines? And there is a couple of case reports, very interesting, few patients that have been vaccinated against varicella, live attenuated vaccine, while on natalizumab without safety concerns. But of course, this has to be proven in larger studies. And that would be very nice to see that patients can be immunized against live attenuated vaccines while on natalizumab. But this, of course, requires much more data. Both of these points that I mentioned are very much in line with the third aspect that I think is also important looking at the future, which is try to individualize recommendations for MS patients. And that, from my perspective, would also need additional data on specific infectious risks linked to DMTs in real life. Because that would mean that we would have much more data in order to specifically recommend certain vaccines for certain DMTs. And even it would allow us to advocate for including some of these vaccines under the regular recommendations system. Another issue that I have not mentioned before, but I think it's quite relevant and there's some work to do in the future, is try to tackle vaccine hesitancy and try to improve vaccine coverage in MS patients. So the experience in working in a large hospital such as Vall d'Hebron with an excellent connection between the MS clinic, SEMCAT, and the preventive medicine, the vaccination unit, really allows for an excellent process in which all the patients are really assessed for the needs of immunization. And I understand this is not an option in every clinic, but at least having the rising the awareness of the importance of vaccination and addressing that vaccine hesitancy or those misthoughts about vaccination that I believe sometimes patients do have is another issue that would be important. And then I guess patient associations, experts in general, the MSologists in general, I think, is a mission that we do have also for the next years. And just to finalize a word on if we're talking about future, we have to also mention EBV vaccine, which I guess is in the far future, or at least not in the near future, but the possibility of having a vaccine, and we'll have to see if it's a vaccine for primary prevention, which seems not that possible, but maybe to control persistent infection, we will have to see what role would that have in MS or as a problem. At least it is a promising intervention for MS. So we will see to that, but I guess we'll have to wait some more.
Thank you, Susanne. It was a very nice resume of the vaccines. So vaccines are important as a central place in our when we counsel MS patients, because we have to prevent infections. The infection can activate the disease. However, we have to plan the vaccination carefully to get the most effective vaccines in patients on immunosuppressive therapies. And real-world data, it's very important to answer future questions on vaccine effectiveness and the necessity of the vaccination, and of course, how to individualize to the patient's needs. And thank you for listening.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.